This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Hawaii by James A. Michener. Introduction by Steve Barry. Read for you by Larry A. McKeever. With an introduction read by Fred Sanders. Introduction. Steve Barry. I grew up in the 1960s. A time when the extent of reading material for kids was, to say the least, limited. R.L. Stein, J.K. Rowling, Suzanne Collins, and so many others had yet to come along. In fact, what we now know as the young adult genre had yet to be invented. Back then, at least for me, it was Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. A limited selection, but what gems those tales were. Each loaded with action, adventure, secrets, and conspiracies. Wondrous stories to fuel young imaginations. I devoured them. Then one day when I was 16 years old, a friend handed me a dog-eared paperback copy of Hawaii by James Michener. Its 1,000 pages immediately intimidated me, as did the small print. I'd never seen so much information packed into one book. The opening sentence alone contained 36 words, monstrous in comparison to the prose of Franklin W. Dixon. But what a sentence! Millions upon millions of years ago, when the continents were already formed and the principal features of the Earth had been decided, there existed, then as now, one aspect of the world that dwarfed all others. I kept reading. What unfolded was a saga spanning many centuries that described how a tiny group of islands in the Pacific Ocean were formed by nature, then settled by man. The epic involved Polynesians, Chinese, Japanese, Europeans, and Americans. Its massive chapters, hundreds of pages long, featured one expansive episode after another, each intertwined, forming a chronicle that defined both the land and its culture. I read it cover to cover. Then I found more books by this guy Michener and read every one. Eventually, I started collecting them, and now, more than 40 years later, I own a first edition of each, save one, Tales of the South Pacific. That book is hard to find. Only a few thousand were printed, and if by some miracle one of those 1947 first editions can be found, the price is through the roof. I keep every one of my Michener books prominently displayed, wrapped in plastic. I see them every day. They are a source of pride and comfort. Today I write modern-day thrillers in which history plays a central role. Without question, the seed for that technique was planted the day I discovered Hawaii. James Michener led an incredible life. Born in 1907, he was orphaned but was soon adopted by a woman named Mabel Michener, who was already raising two other children. Some of his biographers have hypothesized that he was actually Mabel's natural son, the adoption story used to protect both of their reputations. No one knows the truth, and as an adult, Michener refused to comment on the subject. By the time he turned 10, the family had moved to Bucks County, Pennsylvania. They were poor, barely able to put food on the table. His classmates, and even a teacher or two, tormented Michener about the secondhand clothes and toeless sneakers he wore every day. Later in life, he recounted that taunting with a sly smile and a twinkle in his eye. He would say that those early years instilled in him an appreciation for life that he never forgot. They taught him about living simply and not attaching too much value to material things. And though he eventually earned hundreds of millions of dollars from writing, he always feared ending up poor. Before he'd even reached 20 years of age, Michener had traveled across the country in boxcars, by thumbing rides, or simply walking. He worked in carnival shows and other odd jobs, and he visited all but three states. Of that time, he wrote in his 1991 autobiography, The World is My Home, Those were years of wonder and enchantment. Some of the best years I would know. I kept meeting American citizens of all levels who took me into their cars, their confidence, and often their homes. He would also say that those wandering years spurred inside him an insatiable curiosity about people, cultures, and faraway lands. In 1925, he entered Swarthmore College, a prestigious Quaker institution, on a four-year scholarship, graduating with highest honors. He attended graduate school in Scotland, then returned home and taught at a school in Bucks County. He eventually ended up in New York City, editing textbooks at Macmillan Publishing. World War II changed everything. At age 40, Michener enlisted in the Navy, where he discovered the enchanting South Pacific. He earned the rank of lieutenant commander and was made a naval historian, assigned to investigate cultural problems on the various islands. A near-fatal crash landing in French New Caledonia altered the course of his life. He wrote in his autobiography, "As the stars came out and I could see the low mountains I had escaped, I swore, 'I'm going to live the rest of my life as if I were a great man.'" And despite the terrible braggadocio of those words, I understood precisely what I meant. That brush with death also made him realize what every soldier was experiencing during the war, and that one day, when the danger had passed, people might want to recall those things. So each night he began writing down observations, recording comments, describing people and places. 50 years later, in 1991, he said, "Sitting there in the darkness, illuminated only by the flickering lamplight, I visualized the aviation scenes in which I had participated, the landing beaches I'd seen, the remote outposts, the exquisite islands with bending palms, and especially the valiant people I'd known, the French planters, the Australian coast watchers, the Navy nurses, the Tonkinese laborers, the ordinary sailors and soldiers who were doing the work, and the primitive natives to whose jungle fastness I had traveled." All of that became Tales of the South Pacific. The story of how that first manuscript made it to print is typical Michener, an unexpected combination of skill, determination, and luck. Using a pseudonym, he submitted the work to Macmillan, the publisher he'd worked for before enlisting. He omitted his name because he knew the company had a strict policy against publishing anything by an employee. Once the war was over, he definitely intended to return to work there. But at the time of the submission, he was technically a naval officer and not an employee. So the company bought the book, which was published in 1947. 1 year later, Tales of the South Pacific won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. He changed publishers in 1949, moving to Random House, where he stayed for the rest of his life. More books followed: The Fires of Spring, Return to Paradise, The Bridges at Tokori, and Sayonara. Also in 1949, he moved to Honolulu and soon began work on his most ambitious project to date. 4 years of research and 3 years of writing were needed to produce Hawaii. Its epic scope, length, and breadth proved to be the stamp of Michener's trademark style, one he would master over the next 40 years. Legend has it that he finished Hawaii on March 18, 1959, the day Congress voted to accept the islands as the 50th state. In 1962, Michener ran for Congress as a liberal Democrat, but lost. Then in 1968, he worked as secretary of the Pennsylvania Constitutional Convention. Outer space was a lifelong interest, and he served on NASA's advisory council, an experience that led to his novel, Space. Honors were something he shied away from, but in 1977, Gerald Ford bestowed upon him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award. Eventually, he wrote nearly 50 books, including 5 on Japanese art. His work has been translated into multiple languages, and there are more than 75 million copies of his books in print. These latest editions, being re-released with new covers, will only add to that already staggering inventory. A myth associated with Michener speaks of his cadre of researchers, used to gather the enormous amount of historical detail included in each of his epics. The reality was quite different. Most of the work was accomplished with the help of only three secretaries. He was a disciplined writer, establishing a routine early in his career and maintaining it his entire life. An early riser, he would go straight to work, where he wrote using a manual typewriter. He then had a light breakfast, maybe a meeting or two, and went back to work until around 1 p.m. Evenings were a time to be by himself. In the final year of his life, at age 90, he still kept to his daily routine, except he spent 3 days a week at a renal treatment center undergoing kidney dialysis. The treatment proved painful in a multitude of ways, perhaps the most difficult being that it prevented him from straying far from home. The man who'd visited nearly every country could no longer travel. He told an interviewer at the time, "I sit in the TV room and see shows on the big ships I used to travel or areas that I used to wander, and a tear comes to my eye. It's not easy." And that explains his death. He simply decided there would be no more dialysis. Instead, he welcomed the end. Michener died on October 16, 1997. I recall the day vividly. A segment on the evening news reported that he was gone. A sadness came over me, as if I'd lost a close friend, which, in a sense, I had. In preparation for writing this introduction, I reviewed many articles written just after Michener passed. Most came from folks who'd had some personal contact with him through the years, an experience that had clearly stuck in their memory. All of them recounted what happened as if they had been in the presence of a king or head of state. It seemed a privilege to have spent just a little time with James Michener. And that legacy lives on. Though he was known to be fanatically frugal, he gave away more than $100 million. Recipients of his generosity included libraries, museums, and universities. He donated $30 million to the University of Texas for the establishment of a creative writing program. Several million more went to the creation of the James A. Michener Art Museum in Pennsylvania. One wing of that building was named for his third wife, Mari Sabusawa Michener, who died before him in 1994. He never really liked talking about himself, and he could frustrate interviewers. "Famous is a word I never use," he would say. "I'm well known. I've written 30 or 40 books. I've done a great deal. I let it go at that." He was extremely generous with his autograph, so much so that he once noted, "The most valuable books are those that aren't signed." Of my own collection, only one bears his signature. To the frequently asked question, "Which book are you most proud of?" he would just smile and say, "The one I'm working on next." By no means was he perfect. He could be a difficult man to know. He wasn't the type to start conversations with strangers, and he detested small talk. He had few close friends, and those who counted themselves in that number knew to tread lightly. He could be abrupt, even rude, and quite aloof. After his death, we learned that he utilized collaborators on some of the big books, a fact he refused to acknowledge in life. He was married 3 times, and at one point maintained a mistress. He was a multimillionaire, yet he would constantly fret about not having enough money to pay his bills. And though he was an orphan himself and a co-founder of an adoption agency, in the 1950s he gave up his claim to an adopted child when he divorced his second wife, all of which shows that he was human. But still, what a remarkable man. Michener possessed an incomparable ability to simultaneously enthrall, entertain, and inform. Nobody else could write a 200-word sentence with such grace and style. And he chose his subjects with great care. The South Pacific, Tales of the South Pacific, Return to Paradise, Judaism, The Source, South Africa, The Covenant, the West Indies, Caribbean, the American West, Centennial, the Chesapeake Bay, Chesapeake, Texas, Alaska, Spain, Iberia, Mexico, Poland, the Far East. Like millions of other readers, I loved them all. I never met James Michener. I would have loved to tell him how much he sparked the imagination of a 16-year-old boy, which first led to a lifelong love of reading, then to a career as a writer. When, in 1990, I decided to write my first novel, it was Michener who influenced me most. By the end of the decade, though, changes had firmly begun to take hold. Today you won't encounter many 200-word sentences and few millennia-long sagas involving hundreds of characters. Instead, in the 21st century, story, prose, and purpose are expected to be tight. In the internet age, with video games, 24-hour news, streaming movies, you name it, there is just little time for 1,000-page sagas. Toward the end of his life, Michener gave an interview in which he doubted he would have ever been published if he'd first started in that environment. Thank goodness he came along when he did. Now his stories can live forever.
This is a novel. It is true to the spirit and history of Hawaii, but the characters, the families, the institutions, and most of the events are imaginary. Except that the English schoolteacher, Uliasutai Karakoram Blake, is founded upon a historical person who accomplished much in Hawaii. Chapter 1. From the Boundless Deep. Millions upon millions of years ago, when the continents were already formed and the principal features of the earth had been decided, there existed, then as now, one aspect of the world that dwarfed all others. It was a mighty ocean, resting uneasily to the east of the largest continent, a restless, ever-changing, gigantic body of water that would later be described as Pacific. Over its brooding surface, immense winds swept back and forth, whipping the waters into towering waves that crashed down upon the world's seacoasts, tearing away rocks and eroding the land. In its dark bosom, strange life was beginning to form, minute at first, then gradually of a structure now lost even to memory. Upon its farthest reaches, birds with enormous wings came to rest and then flew on. Agitated by a moon stronger then than now, immense tides ripped across this tremendous ocean, keeping it in a state of torment. Since no great amounts of sand had yet been built, the waters where they reached shore were universally dark, black as night, and fearful. Scores of millions of years before man had risen from the shores of the ocean to perceive its grandeur and to venture forth upon its turbulent waves, this eternal sea existed, larger than any other of the earth's features, vaster than the sister oceans combined, wild, terrifying in its immensity, and imperative in its universal role. How utterly vast it was! How its surges modified the very balance of the earth! How completely lonely it was, hidden in the darkness of night, or burning in the dazzling power of a younger sun than ours! At recurring intervals, the ocean grew cold. Ice piled up along its extremities, and so pulled vast amounts of water from the sea, so that the wandering shoreline of the continents sometimes jutted miles farther out than before. Then, for 100,000 years, the ceaseless ocean would tear at the exposed shelf of the continents, grinding rocks into sand and incubating new life. Later, the fantastic accumulations of ice would melt, setting cold waters free to join the heaving ocean, and the coasts of the continents would lie submerged. Now the restless energy of the sea deposited upon the ocean bed layers of silt and skeletons and salt. For a million years, the ocean would build soil, and then the ice would return, the waters would draw away, and the land would lie exposed. Winds from the north and south would howl across the empty seas and lash stupendous waves upon the shattering shore. Thus the ocean continued its alternate building and tearing down. Master of life, guardian of the shorelines, regulator of temperatures and heaving sculptor of mountains, the great ocean existed. Millions upon millions of years before man had risen upon Earth, the central areas of this tremendous ocean were empty, and where famous islands now exist, nothing rose above the rolling waves. Of course, crude forms of life sometimes moved through the deep, but for the most part, the central ocean was marked only by enormous waves that arose at the command of moon and wind. Dark, dark, they swept the surface of the empty sea, falling only upon themselves, terrible and puissant and lonely. Then one day, at the bottom of the deep ocean, along a line running 2,000 miles from northwest to southeast, a rupture appeared in the basalt rock that formed the ocean's bed. Some great fracture of the Earth's basic structure had occurred, and from it began to ooze a white-hot liquid rock. As it escaped from its internal prison, it came into contact with the ocean's wet and heavy body. Instantly, the rock exploded, sending aloft through the 19,000 feet of ocean that pressed down upon it columns of released steam. Upward, upward for nearly 4 miles they climbed, those agitated bubbles of air, until at last upon the surface of the sea they broke loose and formed a cloud. In that instant, the ocean signaled that a new island was building. In time, it might grow to become an infinitesimal speck of land that would mark the great central void. No human beings then existed to celebrate the event. Perhaps some weird and vanished flying thing spied the escaping steam and swooped down to inspect it. More likely, the roots of this future island were born in darkness and great waves and brooding nothingness. For nearly 40 million years, an extent of time so vast that it is meaningless, only the ocean knew that an island was building in its bosom, for no land had yet appeared above the surface of the sea. For nearly 40 million years, from that extensive rupture in the ocean floor, small amounts of liquid rock seeped out, each forcing its way up through what had escaped before, each contributing some small portion to the accumulation that was building on the floor of the sea. Sometimes 1,000 years, or 10,000, would silently pass before any new eruption of material would take place. At other times, gigantic pressures would accumulate beneath the rupture, and with unimaginable violence rush through the existing apertures, throwing clouds of steam miles above the surface of the ocean. Waves would be generated which would circle the globe and crash upon themselves as they collided 12,000 miles away. Such an explosion, indescribable in its fury, might in the end raise the height of the sub-ocean island a foot. But for the most part, the slow, constant seepage of molten rock was not violently dramatic. Layer upon layer of the Earth's vital core would creep out, hiss horribly at the cold seawater, and then slide down the sides of the little mountains that were forming. Building was most sure when the liquid rock did not explode into minute ashy fragments.